Hey, so after 2 weeks, this is the status of our chart. You can see the...
We're on the ellipse.
Column B. Column B, which is passages in the Bible that express instruction for nonviolence and not participating in war or government or law enforcement, is a much longer column than the neutral column, which has only four passages that really don't address the issue in any clear enough way. And then column A, which is the one passage which possibly suggests Christian involvement in self-defense, war, or government. So we really only have one passage left, and that's in, well, I guess there's a couple of things we're going to touch on in Romans, but last week we sort of went through a large set of verses dealing with this. So the first passage we went to was what? What was the first passage? We've kind of been going chronologically from the beginning of the New Testament, except for this Roman section, but what was the first passage we went to? It was a major passage of the study. Matthew 5. So, just somebody want to sum up, Don, why don't you sum up what basically we saw in Matthew 5 and why that was significant for the study?
Jesus giving a new teaching and contrasting it with the old teaching?
Yeah, be more specific though. You're having a conversation with somebody, you have to be honest.
I would say Jesus gave a new command and he contrasted it with the commands from the Old Testament directly.
Yeah.
And he reversed those.
Yeah, now why is that relevant to the study? I mean, what kind of commands are you talking about? What command did he give?
To not take revenge or repay somebody for evil.
Yeah. And so, you know, like, I guess you could...
I mean,
I think you don't understand what we're saying. You know, some of this is practice in terms of being able to articulate it. So I
mean,
it was okay
in the Old Testament to repay people. I mean, that was set up that way.
Yeah,
and to do that, so it was legitimate. I mean, if somebody wronged you or evil was done,
what did Jesus have to say about your taking action and your attitude, or the justness of the cause? Let me put it that way: taking action and the justness of the cause. What does Matthew 5 indicate about those things?
He does indicate that it's okay to be angry as long as you have just cause,
yeah.
But it doesn't bring up the justness of the cause with regards to repaying evil with evil. Or
he seems to allow for you to be angry with if you have a just cause, but he does not seem to allow for you to take action if you have a just cause. That's, I think, a succinct way of expressing what Jesus articulates there from the beginning to the end. And so because he's dealing with the Old Testament code, the law code, and he's replacing that specifically and not allowing us things that were allowed under that law code, it's very important for our study because it sets the tone for what the situation is going to be in the New Covenant. So when we looked at a bunch of other passages, well, what do passages like Ephesians 6 and 2 Corinthians 10 have to do with this, possibly? What's 2 Corinthians 10 talking about? What is Paul talking about there?
That's the one talking about spiritual warfare.
That
where the Christians are involved in is not what people of this earth war at.
Yeah, and the weapons are not weapons of the flesh, and we don't war after the flesh, and that's what Ephesians 6 says. Similarly, we don't wrestle, we don't struggle against flesh and blood, so indicating what we would expect if the New Testament, if the apostles and the early church understood Jesus' statements in places like Matthew 5 to prevent Christians from using physical means as retribution for injustice or to prevent injustice, we would expect them to be expressing later these kinds of statements that we don't involve ourselves in that kind of action for justice, for defense. I think those are somewhat helpful there. When we looked at passages like, there's a passage in early in Luke where John the Baptist is approached by some soldiers, and he tells them not to extort money from people. How do people often look at a passage like that, or a passage where the centurion comes to Jesus to ask him to heal his servant, and Jesus heals the servant? How do people sometimes use those in this discussion? I know we keep going back to you, but I think it's probably
I know if you're looking over at Cody, they usually use that as to appeal to what it is the person's involved with as being okay. In this case, centering being part of the military.
Yeah, and so how's the argument work? They're making.
Well, Jesus must have approved the centurion to make a statement against.
All right. Yeah. So, how do we deal with that? If someone goes, well, Jesus healed the centurion's servant, and he didn't tell the centurion to stop being a soldier, therefore he must be okay to be a soldier. How do we respond with that? What's a potential way to test that?
There's two.
Either one, whatever you got.
Okay. First one's the woman at the well.
Okay.
The Samaritan.
Yep.
Second one is, what do you need?
Well, you don't need the examples. What's the principle exhibited there?
The principle is that Jesus may not be directly condemning something that somebody's doing. He may be teaching something else, but it doesn't mean, since he's not bringing up another thing, that if he's already taught something out of it, that he's...
Right.
Doesn't have a teaching or an understanding or...
Right. And the woman at the well is clearly in fornication. And Jesus doesn't say, hey, stop living in fornication to her. He's teaching her about, the subject of the chapter is about something else. And so when we come up with these examples with the centurion, which is a great example, or Cornelius, who's a centurion in Acts 10, we know that chapter is not necessarily dealing with the issue of government service or anything like that. Just because it doesn't address it doesn't mean it approves of everything that's going on there. Okay, so... I think we kind of handled that stuff. John 18:36, I believe, was the statement Jesus made to Pilate that was somewhat significant. What does Jesus say to Pilate and during his trial that's relevant to this? Yeah.
Is this the one where he says his kingdom is not now?
Yeah, and he says if it were now of this world, what would happen?
His servants would fight.
And so the implication is, as long as Jesus' kingdom is not of this world, his servants will not fight. And it's not denying that it ever will, saying that it will never be of this world, because he places that word now, which appears there in the Greek, in that saying that at some point it will be. And so we deal with that. And the only other thing that I think we should talk about is there's this event that's recorded in all of the Gospels at Jesus' arrest, in which... according to John's gospel, I think it's Peter that takes a sword and cuts off one of the servants of the group that had come to arrest Jesus, and Jesus heals them. And how do people sometimes use that passage in relation to this study? The question about whether or not Christians can use violence.
Well, earlier in the passage, Jesus tells them to ask them if they have swords.
Yeah, why does Jesus do that? Why does Jesus ask them if they have swords?
According to the passage itself.
According to Luke. So let's
quote Psalms or Isaiah or something?
Isaiah. Quotes Isaiah. And what's the... Does anybody remember the line of thought that Jesus is connecting? Why is he connecting?
Transgressors.
Yeah, there's a prophecy in Isaiah that says that Jesus will be... The Messiah will be numbered as a criminal or counted among transgressors. And so he gives that as his reason for why they should have swords. And then what's their response when he makes that statement? I don't remember what they did. We have two swords. What does that indicate? The fact that they remark immediately that they have two swords. What does that indicate in terms of how they understood Jesus' statement?
Like, is it immediately now, I guess?
Yeah. It wasn't a broad statement to take swords with you whenever you go about doing anything in this world and evangelizing people. It's a, we need swords now to fulfill this prophecy regarding my arrest that I will be counted as a transgressor. And that's why they have swords with them at the arrest, apparently, because Luke's explaining this situation.
I have a quick question. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they... I mean, there are a lot of things that Jesus taught that they didn't understand yet.
Mm-hmm.
The fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. Do you think that they would have understood it even... anything different other than contemporary right now? Because he had said, you know, Son of Man must suffer these things, and they just didn't understand. So even if it was prophetic, I mean, they may not have even... You know what I'm saying?
I think it's clear that they understood that whatever he was telling them dealt with their immediate circumstance of his impending arrest, and not a general circumstance, because they didn't say, cool, you know, we'll be sure we have swords with us whenever we go out. They said, we have two swords with us right now. And Jesus said, that's a sufficient amount. And so
it's clearly not a sufficient amount for all 12 or all 120 followers to go out preaching the gospel.
No. So
he's got the sword, right? To Paul, so and so in Ephesus, and have them send one of the two swords.
So
it seems very odd for him to tell him to take up swords, and then as soon as Peter uses it, he tells him to put it away.
Right.
And you know, if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Kind of seems.
What did that go? Yeah, you just look. I feel like this is sort of a setup, boy. You just ask him to pull it.
So. I think we've pretty much covered the arguments that come out of the Gospels, and then I don't really want to spend a whole lot of time recapping all the various ones in the epistles, although we may revisit one portion of Peter's epistle as we compare it to what Paul has to say in Romans. I want to look at...
You think there's one thing that is sort of a good... one of the general themes of the New Testament, you know, that you have a lot of, whether it's Paul otherwise writing to Christians and encouraging them. What was one of the major areas or reasons that Christians were in need of encouragement at that time?
Because they were being persecuted.
Right, they were being persecuted. So the theme of the New Testament is typically one in which Christians are sort of being attacked, but not attacking or defending.
And Jesus, you know, tells them that as he sends them out as sheep among wolves, meaning that they're not supposed to be wolves among wolves.
Interesting. In the entire Old Testament, you get a bunch of commands, go forth, rout your enemy, do this. In the New Testament, you don't have any of that.
Yeah, there's a pretty big contrast between Moses' statements about this and Jesus' statements as he sends people out. I think we'll come back to Peter at some point as we sort of pull that together with Romans 12 and 13. Let's look at a couple of quick passages at the end of Romans, and then we'll jump back to chapters 12 and 13.
Again, I know we looked at Romans, was it 10?
Yeah, we already did that.
Let's look at it again this week, even if we don't make many comments.
All right, Romans 10, 15.
Romans 10,
15.
Romans 10, 15 says, how will they preach except that they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace and bring glad tidings of good things. So I think Brian's point last week was, how can it be a gospel of peace if they're carrying swords with them about to, as they evangelize? It's kind of a seems like a pretty serious contradiction to me. We come in peace and you hold the sword out to them. That's not really going to work. So that's that. Let's look at Romans 14:19. We'll see some similar statements. Mm-hmm. He says, let us therefore follow after the things which make for peace. I think in this context he's talking about, you know, Christians not fighting, you know, struggling with other Christians for things. So it's not a clear verse in the favor of nonviolence. Although, obviously, if Christians are supposed to live at peace with one another, you wouldn't argue that they can therefore be violent with the rest of the world, because what does Jesus have to say about enemies and neighbors?
Enemies and friends?
Enemies and your friends.
Love
your enemies, because everybody else is fine, is nice with their family and friends, but they hate their enemies. So good is it if you're just like that? So,
and then this statement here where he says pursue peace, pursue things which make for peace, relates to the statement made by Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says, blessed are the peacemakers. And so there's this connotation there of generally Christians are supposed to be about making peace, not about violence.
Yeah. The last one that we have, and I think this, again, we're just trying to cover all of our all of the possible bases, is Romans 16:19-22. And this is where Paul says, your obedience has come abroad unto all men. I am glad, therefore, on your behalf. But yet I would have you wise unto that which is good and simple concerning evil. And the God of peace will bruise Satan under your feet shortly. So, again, this emphasis on peace. I don't know. I'm sure there's really anything else we want to pull out of that, is there?
I don't know why we have 22 down there.
I don't know either. I don't think... I think you included this one, so I was kind of looking at you to see if there's anything else you wanted to add.
I do like the language in verse 20, though, and the God of peace will crush Satan under your feet shortly. So the idea here, obviously, is that Satan is a Greek word for adversary, and the concept is that God is the one who is going to be subduing your adversary. In this case, you're not being empowered by God to necessarily subdue the adversary through your own strength.
Yeah. All right, so let's go to Romans 12 and verse. I guess we'll start with verse 18 or verse 17. So the first verse, the first portion of Romans 12:17 is, "Repay no man evil for evil." Now, how does that relate to something we read early on?
I say Matthew 5.
Yeah, Matthew 5. What is Jesus starting with before he introduces the statement, you know, if someone slaps you on the cheek, turn the other cheek? What does he introduce that with? You've heard it said of old time, what?
Eye for an eye,
tooth for tooth, right? And we understood Jesus there to be saying, look, the Old Testament allowed you to repay someone in kind for an injustice done to you. That was a just cause and just retribution for it. And then he said, but don't, when someone slaps you on the cheek, allow them to, you know, slap you on the other cheek, carry their mile, their gear an extra mile. You know? And in here, Paul starts this section with this phrase, do not repay one man evil for evil. So clearly I think Paul is relating to what Jesus said in Matthew 5 and what the Old Testament allowed for repaying in kind. So we would assume these are going to be connected in some way. I think when we see Paul doing this, I think it's clear that he's about to elaborate on something from Jesus. He's not introducing a new teaching. He says, provide things honest in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as it is dependent upon you, live peaceably with all men. And so I don't know how much we want to hit on each one, but you know,
to me, that verse just comments on the idea that for your part, you know, as much as it depends on you, other people may do violence to you as a Christian, and you can't really stop them from doing that. But concerning your part, your response, you don't do violence.
Right.
On your part, your obligation is peace. And I think verse 19 has to be read in that context, you know, because I think immediately the question is, well, as much as it depends on you, but if they start the fight, then I can finish it.
But then what does verse 17 have to say about that?
Evil for evil.
Right, so if they start the fight, what's your option? You can't repay them for evil for evil, so the phrase as much as it lies with you clearly doesn't overturn that idea. It's meaning you don't fight back.
And verse 14 says, bless those who persecute you, bless them, do not curse.
Yep.
Verse 12, patient in tribulation.
Yep. So let's keep going here.
Good contextual clues.
All right, so let's keep going here into verse 19. He says, dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves. So we'll just stop for a second. How does that relate to verse 18? You know, verse 18, you know, says, if it's as much as is it based upon you, live peaceably with all men. And if somebody wants to say, well, to a point, I mean, if they start it, it's the same thing as verse 17. No, don't avenge yourselves. Even if they start it, don't avenge yourself. How this is concluding. There's no way to mistake what verse 18 means. And so, how does not avenge not yourselves? How does that relate to the Old Testament?
Could take action against somebody.
Yeah. What is and does, I don't know. You guys don't know. I'm gonna pull. You probably know because we've done this before. But the word avenge here is a verb. It's agdikeo, and it means to retaliate or punish, to vindicate. Okay, so this comes from a noun. It's ekdikos, which means to carry out justice or to punish. So he's saying here, do not carry out justice for yourselves. Don't you be the one who's carrying out justice. In the Old Testament, this concept, in the legal jargon of the day, this is not a vigilante justice. This is actual legal justice, legally allowed means of justice. Do not avenge yourselves, rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will pay, says the Lord. So according to these verses, who is it that's going to pay back other people for injustices that they're going to do against Christians? It's not Christians, right? You couldn't read that and come to that conclusion. It's very impossible to come to that conclusion. And then he says, therefore, if your enemy hungers, feed him. If he thirsts, give him something to drink. This seems to me right alongside of what Jesus is saying in the Sermon on the Mount.
This is Cody wrote earlier about blessing those who persecute you.
Be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. So don't do back to them what they're going to do to you. Act differently towards them. Act good towards them. So if we continue, because obviously this Paul's continuing here, he didn't write and then the new chapter starts.
One of the questions obviously from verse 19 is, okay, when is God going to, or in what manner is God going to enact vengeance?
Right.
Because some people would probably suggest that he does this through, maybe yourself in some sense, when you take action or you defend your household, or maybe something like that. Strange that that's going to be answered here, but
yeah, I mean, we've established so far that the you're not supposed to do it, God's going to do it, and so we have this sort of question: is how is God going to take care of this, and possibly when is God going to take care of this? So if we read in continuing to chapter 13, you can see that Paul's got the same discussion in mind. He says, let every soul be subject unto higher powers.
Let me read that from this, or you can read it from this.
No, that's okay. Good.
It says, let every soul be subject to the governing authorities.
So the governing authorities. So, I mean, you could certainly be living in accordance with the law if you were a part of the government, but if you simply read the phrase, you be subject to the government, does that put you... I mean, you could break this down into a category. There's the government on one side, there's you on the other, and you're the one subjecting to the government. These are not two, it's not like you have two parties and they're the same thing. The government being subject to the government, you being subject to yourselves. It's you being subject to the government, meaning that you and the government are not the same thing. There's a clear separation there. We'll keep reading in that verse and probably better.
Yeah, verse 1 continues, but there is no authority except from God. And the authorities that exist are appointed by God.
What's the major question of our study?
Can we participate in violence?
And you could say it more broadly, right? Which is, can Christians use action or violence as a means of administrating justice or government or warfare? So the key question in Romans isn't whether or not somebody's supposed to do it, it's whether or not we are that somebody. So far, he's told us, no, you can't avenge. God's going to avenge. And now he's telling us to be subject to the government and that the governments are appointed by God. And then he continues. He says, therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God. So in this statement, are you the authority? Are you God? Are you the person who potentially resists? You're certainly not the government. He's not talking about how people might resist you. And you're certainly not God, so you're in the other category. You're not part of the governing power. And those who resist will bring judgment on themselves. And he says, for rulers are not a terror to good works, to those who do good, but to evil. Do you want to be afraid of the authority?
The key issue here is that the governing authority is being referred to as a third party in an address where the Christians are the immediate audience. He's clearly addressing a particular audience using things like you, et cetera, et cetera. But then when he is talking about the government, they're a third party that's not related to the audience directly. Yeah.
I have some questions when we finish this section. I want to make sure that I don't break your line.
It doesn't matter.
But this is probably one of the stickiest situations.
Go ahead.
I understand it. I mean, as we're going through it and stuff, but I think that. I've never gone over this stuff. This is the first time. But when we talked about it and stuff, it's always been difficult. Well, if God approves of having a governing body or authorities or lawmakers and stuff like that, it's hard to not think of Christians being involved in that, because in the Old Testament you have a situation where he gives the law, mm-hmm. and the Jews enforce the law.
Sure.
So it's you know, an odd concept. It's not odd.
That was the Old Testament perception, sure.
No, I understand that. And a lot of people are going to go, what? You know, you don't think judges are good? And the, I mean, those types of arguments, sure. For me, it was just hard to, you know, to understand that. You know,
so there's a couple relevant things to keep in mind. Number one, obviously the Old Testament context, if this was in the Old Testament, we would read it differently. But this isn't right. The Old Testament. If you want a context, is you have to ask what the experience was of the church. Were they the persons in governmental power as in the same way that God had authorized the Israelites to be over the land of Canaan? And they weren't. I mean, that's contrary to the New Testament language. Second, regardless of that, those facts in today's context in which Christians are part of the government, you have to ask the question when you read through here, which category is Paul placing the believers in as he talks about different people and the responsibility for government and punishing injustice? Are they a part of that party that's supposed to be responsible for those things, or are they not?
I don't think they're a part of the Roman government.
They clearly are not conceptually here for Paul in the verses we've read so far. So
no, it's good. In that case, there's three.
And Paul's
part of God, the lawmakers or people who are subject to it. It's very clear.
Yeah. And Paul's describing, his language here is descriptive, relates to a system in which the Christians are not the governing authorities, but the governing authorities can be related as an outside party. In this discussion, I mean, that if you were going to say, what was the situation? Can we detect it? What it was from Paul's writings? That would be how you would describe it. You wouldn't go and infer that it's possible that the Christians were involved in government from the language that Paul uses here. To me, this is a classic scenario where the issue of historical context as an interpretive principle is the most important, because as a Jewish Christian or Gentile Christian in the first century, you are most likely to be among the poor, to be among not the noble class, not likely to be among the Jewish rulers either. So you would not interpret Paul's language in terms of, hey, unless you know you're a governor, and then in that case, then you can take vengeance. And most likely, you're not going to think of it in those terms. But as Americans today or Westerners today, we have a totally different concept of participating in government, and so we tend to interpret it. These passages in terms of our own possibilities and experiences, and that's just historically and biblically hermeneutically correct.
What's going on is you have American Christians or any modern Christian today, and you've just clearly pointed out scripture where they cannot avenge or take action against an injustice. And now that you've done that, you've clearly spelled out a group of people who can, and now they're upset because you're starting to explain to them that even though they can't take action against it, that they still, and they can't even be part of the other group who rightfully can take it. It's frustrating for them. It's a struggle, and then they start to twist it against you to say the other argument, which would be is you can't take action with without a just cause. Or you guys just approve of evil, or what are you going to do when your house gets broken into? Are you going to call the cops? You can't. I mean, those types of arguments.
I can't call the cops. That's what I want to know. Nobody's arguing against that. But the problem here is that the text is pretty clear. If I said when a basketball team takes the court to play the game, I want you to go to the locker room and get their stuff for them. Are you on? Does it seem like you're a member of the basketball team? No, everybody would understand in that sentence that the basketball team is something else and you're probably the manager or something, the cowboy. You're not going to go, but what if I'm on the basketball team? That's kind of a confusing statement. Am I supposed to be on the court or in the locker room getting stuff? Somebody might say, well, maybe Paul's very specific here because he knows that the people he's writing to in Romans aren't part of the government. So there's a response to that in relation to a couple other passages, but what's the potential response? If someone says, well, this is really directed only towards the Romans. And then there are two other texts that relate to this.
The first thing that comes to my mind is he seems to be starting in chapter 12 with some statements that were made on the Sermon on the Mount by Jesus and applied to everybody.
Yeah, that's number one. Sure. Number two, what we read Peter's epistle last week. We probably didn't recover it yet tonight, but Peter's writing in general to Christians from Rome.
There's subjugation.
There's several problems with that line of approach. One is there are other passages. First of all, the original teaching from which Paul is drawing comes from Jesus, where it's made in general to all of his followers. Sure. Two, we have very similar statements made by Peter elsewhere in another epistle, which means that these guys weren't just selecting their audiences particularly. Three, in general, you don't want to take a particular passage you find in an epistle and say, that was only written to this church, not to us, not to the general group, not to the church everywhere in the first century. For one, because we have passages indicating that the apostles taught the same things everywhere. So you don't want to start picking pieces of it and go, well, they only had to obey the kings in Rome. They only had to pay taxes in Ephesus. They only had to work for a living wherever Timothy was at. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, pretty far.
That's ridiculous.
And citizenship. Obviously, we have other passages that talk about that.
Yeah.
Where citizenship is and we're pilgrims.
You know, I think that what people are mostly going to do is with this is like with the stuff we're talking about with the Pharisees. They're going to try to take a statement that was issued to the first century church, and it may be very easy to apply to that, but we don't like the fact that how it would work if it applied today, and we're going to evolve this into a teaching that works for us. We're going to make this statement obsolete, and then we're going to come up with a rule that's in the spirit of this, but still allows us to do whatever we do today. That would be the Pharisees' approach, and that's, of course, not what we're going to do, but that's the type of thing people would be articulating, and I think it's going to fit with what the Pharisees
do. Let's keep back to the text, because we're going to disconnect it. So you might want to read it.
Yeah. Okay, so
just keep the connection.
Okay. No, I'll just say, the other argument I would make is, it's not necessarily true. People are like, well, God shows approval in the authorities, but these are the same systems that on any given day when we see something on television, somebody would say, that's not right, that's unfair, politicians are so corrupt or crooked. You know what I mean? It's just...
Well, I think we have to understand that this idea of God appointing doesn't mean that he approves of every decision that they make. It's an idea of delegating authority. And then he will come back, like you see in the parables, where... someone is given authority, and then when the king comes back, he then questions them on how they've used that, and if they've used it correctly, they're rewarded. If not, then they're not. They're punished.
Those parables were talking largely about his servants, Christians, right?
Absolutely, but I'm saying that the principle that I'm trying to illustrate is one in which someone in this time of history, an authority figure like a king, could delegate and then yet hold responsible for whether or not the servant handled it correctly or incorrectly. Sure. And so when we think of Paul talking about these people being appointed by God, that doesn't mean that God is approving of the way that they're necessarily exercising their authority. Sure. I didn't mean to draw the parallel,
right,
as though the parables were talking about the same subject.
I was fine with that, I just wanted you to be more clear.
I mean, yeah. The smartest move to make.
Well, you know, again, I think the question is, on that note, did God intend to instruct saints to set up a government that was a godly government in this day and age leading up to the return of the Son? If he did not give instructions for us to set up an earthly government, it doesn't matter what our best intentions are or how many of us, if we had a certain quantity, could do a great job at that. The point would be, if God didn't instruct that, then he must have a reason for it, and we shouldn't go about trying to change it.
I would argue that with statements like, if my kingdom is not now from here, so therefore my servants won't fight, and turn the other cheek, and you're not the one who bears the sword, as we're going to read. These are going to make it really hard for Christians to set up a government if you can't do any of that stuff.
But there, I mean, even if you said that the New Testament was silent on this matter, you'd still end up with a situation where if this is what we should be investing so much time in, trying to create a country and a government that's based on Christianity,
that's the point where
why is there not an enormous amount of statements, at least a significantly identifiable amount of statements in the New Testament telling Christians to pursue this? It's absent. It's clearly not something that God intended or predicted would take place.
Well, Michael Brown talked about in the Old Testament about how God gives power and authority over other nations to do things such as punish the nation of Israel.
Yeah.
He eventually stops them because they overpunish them at a certain point.
Just
God giving someone authority to do these things doesn't mean that they have to be like a Christian nation or
if everything they do is what God is approving, right? I wanted to get into real quick, and we're going to approach verse 4. But in verse 1, you know, it says there's no authority, no governing authority, except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. So, you know, Cody just gave a good example of an instance in which a national governing body, like, let's say, the the Babylonians, are appointed by God to serve a particular purpose for chastising his people. Now, obviously, that's right in line with what Paul's talking about here, the people who are doing evil, and God is going to punish them and the people who are appointed to do that. But there's another situation in which, talk about governing authorities, in which we can ask the question, in what way might Paul say, using an Old Testament passage, that God has appointed various, let's say, ungodly nations to rule over the earth? So let's go to Daniel 2. So here's Daniel chapter 2, and Nebuchadnezzar's got this vision of the statue, which depicts a succession of earthly kingdoms and then ultimately the establishment of the Messianic kingdom. And he's describing that, this vision that God has given to the king to see all this. And then Daniel makes a statement in verse 21 regarding God, that he changes the times and the seasons, removes kings, and raises up kings. So concerning the nature of this entire chapter and that statement, how does that relate to Romans 13:1? Is that good enough? Question?
It's clear to me now.
Revelation, Romans 13:1, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. What, in what sense could Paul be saying that?
I would say in light of
God sets up kings.
He sets up various kings to rule over the earth for various periods of time. Yeah. Take, for example, the Babylonians. They weren't usurping authority at first. They were just using the authority that they had rightly been given. And it's not like... So, God has appointed that this should be the case until the Messianic kingdom comes. That's what Paul can be referencing that here. It could be referencing specifically the idea of God using, trying his people through being under the authority of ungodly leadership, ungodly nations and governments. Go ahead.
In fact, from Romans chapter 9, Paul says... where is it? Verse 17 says, "For the Scripture says of the Pharaoh, for this very purpose I have raised you up, that I may show my power in you, and that my name may be declared in you in all the earth." So even earlier in the same book, Paul's talking about God setting up, in this case, a man who was very resistant to God's will, and the purpose was that God might make an example of him. That doesn't mean that every authority that gets set up is going to be made an example out of. But that clearly Paul has already stated that God is going to put certain people in power, and they're going to handle it in the delegated authority one way or another, and then they're either going to be made an example of, or it's going to be a test or a trying for God's people, and maybe in some cases you'll get some guys who are fairly good.
So let's read here. I'm going to read verse 3 and then I'll read verse 4 again. He says, "For rulers are not a terror to those that do good works, but to those who do evil. Do you want to be unafraid of the authority? Then do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For he is God's minister to you for good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain, for he is God's minister, an avenger to execute wrath on him who practices evil. Therefore, you must be subject not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. Because of this, you should pay taxes. For they are God's ministers, attending continually to this very thing. They render, therefore, to all their due, taxes to whom taxes are due, customs to whom customs are due, fear to whom fear is due, honor to whom honor." So let me ask a couple questions, starting with the last verse. Who's receiving taxes in this? Who's paying the taxes? You are paying taxes to someone else, to the government, right?
God, he, and you.
Yeah.
What are you?
That's a great way to look at it, though, grammatically. Because it's very obvious in those terms. You have three categories. You, God, and he.
So you, according to verse 6, are supposed to pay taxes to God's ministers, which, according to this passage, is the governing authorities.
So let's say God's servants.
Right.
Or God's subordinates.
Yeah. You know, it's really plain. Verse 4 is a really explicit verse. For he is God's servant to you. Which category are you? I mean, which person or which place are you in here? He bears the sword. Is that you or someone else? It's clearly not you.
Well, you can go back up and you can answer the question from chapter 12, verse 19, you know, leave space for wrath, for God says, "Vengeance is mine, I will repay." How's he going to repay? Well, clearly, God's got a servant set up to whom he's appointed to bear the sword. for your benefit.
Yeah.
And so you don't enact justice, you don't bear the sword on your own behalf, but God has set up governing authorities and they bear the sword, and in this day and age, you submit to them, and then they take care of injustice, and then God will deal with them.
I mean, when you put verse 19 by verse from chapter 12 right next to verse 4 from chapter 13, and it's, do not take vengeance yourself. The governing authorities are the people who are to avenge and execute wrath on those who practice evil. Is there any way to take those two verses together and go, good Lord, I'll do it, I'll take care of it, I'll go avenge evil?
Well,
it's hard, but I think I can make it work.
I can do it.
Especially verse 17. Repay no one evil for evil.
Right.
Give place for wrath. God will take vengeance. The governing authorities are God's servants to bear the sword and execute wrath on those who practice evil. That, it's very straightforward. You don't do evil. You don't repay. The governing authorities are the ones who take care of that. You let them do it.
There's no way.
What if I run for office? I just see Paul going, shaking his head. You can't run for office in Rome at this time. So. Now let's be clear. In this day and age, when this was written, people weren't running for office.
So I want to really quick go over to
one other thing on that point. Jesus says that when you're brought before rulers to give testimony, it would be for a testimony against them almost, I think, in the sense that it's pretty much assumed that these guys are not going to convert.
Well, and again, in Jesus' statements there, which category, which party are you when you are brought before rulers and councils and governors? But how does that really... Paul's not coming up with something in any way that it's new, as far as I can tell here. He's simply using these things the same way Jesus does. You're Jesus' followers, you're being persecuted, you're being brought before governors, you must submit to these people, they are the ones repaying evil for evil, you're supposed to turn the other cheek. There's absolute consistency there. So I'm trying to find this passage from 1 Peter that we read last week. Okay, here it is. 1 Peter 2:13. And you can ask the same types of questions we were talking about there with Romans or with Jesus' statements. But here he says, therefore, submit yourselves, submit to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors or to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers. I mean, there's at least three parties here. There's God who's appointing these people. There's the governors, kings, and those who punish evildoers. And then there's you. There's not just two categories, God and then you who punish people. That's not correct. And then he says, and for the praise of those who do good. It's the same thing Paul said in Romans. And then he says, I guess that's pretty much it. But somewhere else in here he talks about paying taxes to them. But there's another passage that says, fear God and honor the king. Yeah, that's verse 17 here. Yeah.
You should keep reading that.
Verse 3:20. Servants, be submissive to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and the gentle, but also to the harsh. So you're supposed to submit even to people who are not good authorities, right? You're not supposed to revolt just because they're unjust.
Or if you don't have representation.
So this is commendable because of conscience towards God. If by doing what God asks, you endure grief and suffering wrongfully, that's a commendable thing, right? For what credit is it when you are beaten for a fault and when you take it patiently? So if you're doing it, if you're getting beaten and you're bearing with it, but it's because you deserve it, there's no credit to you in that. But when you do good and suffer and you take it patiently, this is commendable before God. And then he talks about how that's Christ's example. Again, using Christ as and his willingness to submit to the authorities and to be persecuted and put to death as the example for us. It's not like he did that so that we can revolt and take up arms as a unique example. He did that so that we could follow that exact example. So,
like every time that Jesus in the Gospels depicts them being brought before rulers and councils and synagogues, etc., etc., never really turns out well. There's never an expectation that the result of this may be that you will persuade them and then they'll let you out of jail.
It always has to be like that. Is that in the Olivet Discourse or Matthew 10
and the Olivet Discourse versions? So this is Luke 21 and 12. Mark 13. And verse 9 through 12, actually 13.
Okay.
In fact, the great thing about Mark is that he goes right from the statement about being put to death by father and mother and family members to verse 13, where he says, you'll be hated by all for my name's sake. He who endures to the end shall be saved. So to him it seems like this, that Jesus is talking about a situation in which you're testifying before these kings and rulers and people, but that does not bring an end to persecution. You're not going to be persuaded and go, as Constantine did, I am not persuaded, therefore, that there be legalization of Christianity. And then Matthew was, Matthew 10, I guess, is obviously weird. And this concludes very similarly, though, with the idea of when they persecute you in this city, flee to another. You won't run out of cities before the Son of Man comes. So there's never, the anticipation of this process of testifying before kings is never one in which the rulers convert and the persecution ends. It's one in which the rulers are demonstrated to have rejected the gospel and the persecution continues until the return of Christ.
Yeah, I think these last passages that we've looked up here again are showing that when the New Testament talks about governing authorities and it talks about Christians, they're always in two set. They're always completely separate from one another. There's the Christians and then there's the governing party. They're in opposition to one another. It's not like Christians are occupying those government positions. They're being the ones subject to them, brought to them, and punished by them or for trial. They're not confused into a single entity.
I think if you look at this from the perspective, and you see that in the Old Testament with Moses, God sets up this nation with a covenant, with laws that he gives them, that they are the civil laws as well as the religious ordinances. And so the entire governing apparatus of that nation is put in place, and that nation continues up until the first century when the temple is going to be destroyed. And the people of Israel are going to be scattered in two separate events in the first and second century. And they're not going to live there, and they're not going to have that country or that civil institutions anymore. And so just like there's a somewhat anticipation of what are you going to do when there's no possibility of a temple to make sacrifices, how are you going to have atonement? No problem. Jesus already answered this. We've got atoning sacrifice. It's going to cover all men for all time. You don't need a temple anymore for that kind of work. And therefore, Christianity will be able to exist as a successor for Judaism after the destruction of the temple. What are you going to do when the nation of Israel is destroyed, and how are saints going to live, and what kind of society are they going to have when there's no country for them? Well, simple. They're going to have to be subject, good, faithful citizens in whatever countries they live in, and pay taxes, follow the rules, honor the king, and let the king take care of things like justice. Don't you be taking it upon yourselves.
All right, so obviously this chart here that we have has a big middle column with passages where Christians are not involved in government or violence or anything, where we have to live peaceably, where we're not allowed to defend ourselves, where we're being persecuted, and we could have thrown a bunch more in talking about Christians being persecuted in the first century. We've got a very small column of neutral verses, and we could have added a couple more from Romans there that may or may not refer to just Christians living amiably and with one another, just like in James 4. So those don't really help us. And then the only thing that we had really in column A, potentially, was Matthew 10, 34 through 40. And maybe we can look at that again just to look at that and see, like, if this verse, obviously...
is it easier to explain Matthew 10, 34 through 40, or is it easier to take everything in column B, which amounts to probably some 20 or possibly 30 scriptures, and somehow put those in column A?
Yeah, think not that I have come to send peace on earth, but I have come to send the sword. That's the essential concept here. Having enemies in your own home. Loving your family more than Christ. So obviously that's not a very clear verse in terms of pointing out to us that we can be involved in government and stuff like that. It's really not the subject there.
Well, and I think what's easiest to do here is to say that this language here refers to the fact that people, that Jesus will be a controversial figure, and he will cause people to have differing opinions about him. In fact, you see that largely in the Gospel of John, where the crowds are at diverse opinions, even among the Jews. They're not sure who he is, you know, how to regard him. And to say that that's probably all that this verse is talking about, rather than this being sort of a lone verse that talks about the idea of Christians taking up a sword and going after other people to make war for the sake of Christ. Other passages that we didn't look at, but we could have, the Gospels have a counterpart in which Jesus tells Peter, of course, the story to go and get the coin from out of the fish's mouth to pay the temple tax, and also the statement about render taxes, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and render unto God what is God's. All of that language being complementary to what Paul says in Romans about the idea of paying taxes to those who are in authority. And so, once again, there's this idea of not resisting taxation.
All right, so I'm not going to be able to find this very easily, but we saw the passage there. In all the Gospels where at Jesus' arrest, the statement is made, at least in several of them, that if you live by the sword, you will die by the sword. And that's repeated in Revelation. And then in Romans, you have the statement that it's the governors, the governing authorities that bear the sword. So you can see that the sword is being placed in the hands of someone, not the church, again. And so that shows us that Jesus' statement to Peter there in the garden is not a specific statement just to Peter, put down your sword right now. It's what Tertullian says, which is that in disarming Peter, Christ disarmed all soldiers, all who would be followers of him. And so that's clearly the way that Paul is taking it in Romans 12 and 13, where he's saying, they, not you, bear the sword. So you're not supposed to bear the sword. And so we have that very clear statement from Paul, which is an easy thing to throw out there. I mean, the two key passages from this entire discussion are Matthew 5 and then Romans 12 and 13.